came and took it away from him. But what luck, he thought, skittering down the road. What joy! What a coup! This would put a smile on America's face. This would do it. The skin crusted and basted in its own juices, and he would build up the coals first, make an inferno, and let it settle into a bed of coals. And then he would roast the pavo on a spit, slow roast it, sitting right there and turning the spit till it was brown all over and not a blackened spot on it. He hurried down the trail, and nothing bothered him now, not his hip or his cheekbone or the wind in his face, thinking of the beer and the turkey and America. "Gobble, gobble," he called, sloshing across the pool to where she sat like a statue in the sand. "Gobble, gobble, gobble, and guess what Papacito's got for you?" And she smiled. She actually smiled at the sight of the thing, stripped of its head and its feet and its feathers, rolled up into one big ball of meat, turkey meat, a feast for two. She took a sip of beer when he offered it to her, and she pressed his bicep with her hand as he told her the insuperable tale of the turkey, and already the flames were rising, the wind sucking them higher as it tore through the canyon. And should he get up from the sand and the beer and America and all the birds in the trees and the frogs croaking at the side of the pool and feed it some more? He got to his feet. The wind snatched at the fire, and the fire roared. He went up and down the stream bed in search of wood, wrapping the bigger branches against the trunks of the trees to break them down, and every time he came back to feed the fire, America was sitting there cradling the pale white bird as if she'd given birth to it, kneading the cold flesh and fighting to work the thick green spit through the back end of it. "Yes," he told her, "yes, that's the way." And he was happy, as happy as he'd ever been. Right up to the moment when the wind plucked the fire out of its bed of coals and with a roar as loud as all the furnaces of hell set it dancing in the treetops. Part 3. Socorro. 1. "But it's only a couple of blocks," Delaney was saying to the steamed-over bathroom mirror while Kyra moved behind him in the bedroom, trying on clothes. He'd towel-dried his hair, and now he was shaving. Even with the hallway door closed, he could smell the turkey, the entire house alive with the aroma of roasting bird, an aroma that took him back to his childhood and his grandparents' sprawling apartment in Yonkers, the medley of smells that would hit him in the stairwell and grow increasingly potent with each step of the three flights up until it exploded when the door swung open to reveal his grandmother standing there in her apron. Nothing had ever smelled so good. No French bakery in the first hour of light, no restaurant, no barbecue or clam bake. "It seems ridiculous to take the car." Kyra appeared in the bathroom doorway. She was in a black slip, and she'd put her hair up. "Hurry, can't you?" she said. "I need the mirror." "And yes, we're taking the car. Of course we're taking the car. With this wind, my hair would be all over the place." Jordan was in the living room, occupied with the tape-delayed version of the Macy's Parade. Orbelina was scrambling to set the table and clean up the culinary detritus in the kitchen, and Kyra's mother, Kit, was in the guest room, freshening up. Delaney cracked the blinds. The day was clear, hot, wind-driven. "You got a point," he conceded. Back then, he'd always worn a suit, tie, and overcoat, even when he was 5 or 6, as the yellowed black-and-white photos testified. But those were more formal times. Plus, it was cold. There'd be ice on the lakes now, and the wind off the Hudson would have a real bite to it. But what to wear today to Dominic Flood's cocktail party? Delaney sank his face into the towel, padded into the bedroom on bare feet, and pushed through the things in his closet. This was California, after all. You could wear hip boots and a top hat, and nobody would blink twice. He settled finally on a pair of baggy white cotton trousers and a short-sleeved sports shirt Kyra had bought him. The shirt carved alternate patches of white and burgundy across his chest and over his shoulders, and in each burgundy patch the multiplied figures of tiny white jockeys leapt, genuflected, and gambled their way through a series of obscure warm-up exercises. It was California all the way. There must have been 100 people at Dominic Flood's, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, umbrellas flapping over the tables set up in the backyard. A string quartet was stationed under the awning that shaded the den, and the awning was flapping too. Most of the guests were packed in near the bar, where 2 men in tuxedos and red ties were manipulating bottles with professional ease. To the left of the bar, along the interior wall and running the length of the room, was a table laden with enough food for 6 Thanksgiving feasts, including a whole roast suckling pig with a mango in its mouth and fresh steamed lobsters surrounded by multicolored platters of sashimi and sushi. Dominic himself, resplendent in a white linen suit that flared at the ankle to hide the little black box on loan from the Los Angeles County Electronic Monitoring Service, stood just inside the door, greeting guests, a long-stemmed glass in his hand. Delaney maneuvered Kyra and her mother through the crowd to introduce them. "Ah, Delaney," Dominic cried, taking his hand theatrically even as he shifted his hand to Kyra and her mother. "And this must be Mrs. Mossbacher and..." "Kit," Kyra's mother put in, taking Flood's hand. "Kit Menaker. I'm visiting from San Francisco." The string quartet started up then, sawing harshly into something jangling and modern, their faces strained against the rush of wind and the indifferent clamor of the party, and Delaney tuned out the conversation. Kyra's mother, 55, blonde and divorced, with Kyra's nose and legs and an exaggerated self-presence, was the single most coquettish woman Delaney had ever known. She would tangle herself like a vine round Dominic Flood, whose incipient bachelorhood she could smell out in some uncanny, extrasensory way, and she would almost certainly invite him to their little dinner party, only to be disappointed and maybe even a bit shocked by the black manacle on his ankle. And that, of course, would only whet her appetite. "Yes," he heard Kyra say, "but I was just a little girl then," and Kit chimed in with a high, breathless giggle that was like a war cry. Delaney excused himself and drifted off toward the food, picking at a few things here and there. He never could resist a bite of ahi tuna or a spicy scallop roll if it was good, and this was very good, the best. But pacing himself for the feast to come. He smiled at a stranger or two, murmured an apology when he jostled a woman over the carcass of the pig, exchanged sound bites about the weather, and watched the bartender pour him a beer. But all the while he was fretting. He kept envisioning the turkey going up in flames, the potatoes congealing into something like wet concrete, Jordan sinking into boredom and distracting Orbelina with incessant demands for chocolate milk, pudding, cup of noodles, a drink of juice. And their guests. He hadn't yet seen the Jardines or the Cherrystones, though he could hear Jack Cherrystone's booming basso profondo from somewhere out on the back lawn. But he was sure they'd fill up here and push their plates away at dinner. Delaney wasn't very good at enjoying himself. Not in a situation like this. And he stood there in the middle of the crush for a moment, took a deep breath, let his shoulders go slack, and swung his head from side to side to clear it. He was feeling lost and edgy, and maybe even a little bit guilty to be imbibing so early in the afternoon, even on a day dedicated to self-indulgence like this one. When he felt the pressure at his elbow and turned to see Jack, Erna, and Jack Jr. arrayed in smiling wonder behind him. "Delaney," Jack sang out, holding on to the last syllable as if he couldn't let it go. "You look lost." Jack was dressed. 3-piece suit, crisp white button-down shirt, knotted tie. His wife, a cat-like bosomy woman who always insisted on the two-cheek continental style of greeting and would clutch your shoulders with tiny fists until she'd been accommodated, as she did now, was dressed. Delaney saw that she was wearing a shroud-like evening gown, black satin, and at least 60% of her jewelry collection. Even Jack Jr., with his high tops, earrings, and ridiculous haircut, was dressed, in a sport coat that accented the new spread of his shoulders and a tie he must have inherited from his father. "I am lost," Delaney admitted. He hefted the beer and grinned. "It's too early in the afternoon for me to be drinking. You know me and alcohol, Jack, and I got a 6-course dinner to worry about. Which you're going to love, by the way. Old New England, right here in California. Or old New York, anyway."
"Relax, Delaney," Erna purred. "It's Thanksgiving. Enjoy the party."
Jack Jr. gave him a sick grin. He stood a head taller than anyone else in the room. His voice cracked when he excused himself and drifted toward the suckling pig like some incubus of the food chain. "I see from the letters this month you've been taking some heat on that coyote column," Jack said, and a glass of wine seemed to materialize magically in his hand. Erna grinned at Delaney, waved at someone over his shoulder. "Leave it to Jack to bore right in." Delaney shrugged.
"Yeah, I guess so. There've been something like 30 letters, most of them critical, but not all. But that's something. I must have pushed some buttons." Actually, the response had surprised him. He'd never generated, provoked, more than half a dozen letters before, all from literal-minded biologists taking issue with his characterization of the dusky-footed wood rat or his use of the common name of some plant in preference to the scientific. The readers, die-hard preservationists to the last man, woman, and child, had seemed to feel he was advocating some sort of control on coyote populations, and though he'd been upset over Osbert when he wrote the piece, he didn't see the column as being at all environmentally incorrect. After the 10th letter had come in, he'd sat down and reread the column. Twice. And there was nothing there. They just weren't getting it. They weren't reading it in the spirit it was intended. He wasn't pushing for population controls. Controls were futile, and the historical record proved it, as he'd indicated. He was just elucidating the problem, opening up the issue to debate. Certainly it wasn't the coyotes that were to blame. It was us. Hadn't he made that clear? Jack was grinning, his lips ever so slightly drawn back to reveal a strategic flash of enamel. Delaney recognized the expression. It was skeptical, faintly ironic, meant to convey to judges, jurors, and district attorneys alike that the issue had yet to be decided. So what is it, Delaney? Should we bring back the traps and quotas or not? You've lost two dogs, and how many others here have lost pets, too? He made a sweeping gesture to take in the room, the house, the community at large. That's right, Kyra said, slipping up behind Delaney and taking hold of his arm. And that's where we had our falling out over the wall, or actually it was a war, full on, no holds barred. Jack laughed. Erna laughed. Delaney managed a rueful smile as greetings went round and the string quartet built to a frenzy in the Confuoco. But really, Kyra said, unwilling to let it go. Don't you feel safer now, all of you? Jack? Erna? Delaney? Don't you? She said, turning her face to him. Admit it. Delaney reddened, shrugged again. The beer glass in his hand was heavy as a cannonball. I know when I'm licked, he was saying, but Erna Jardine had already leapt in to answer for him. Of course we do, she said. We all do. The wall's barely been completed, and yet I'm breathing easier to know there'll never be another rattlesnake in my garage. Or another break-in. She gave them a pious look. Oh, I know that doesn't mean we can let our guard down, but still, it's one more barrier, isn't it? She said. And then she leaned into Kyra and lowered her voice confidentially. Did you hear about Shelley Shurik? It was a follow home right down the hill in Calabasas. The party went on. Delaney fretted. Had a second beer. Jack Cherrystone joined them and gave a farcical synopsis of a movie he'd just done the trailer for, yet another apocalyptic futuro cyberpunk vision of Los Angeles in the 21st century. People gathered round when he shifted from the merely thunderous tones of his everyday voice to the mountain-toppling hysteria of the one he wielded professionally. They brokered babies, he roared, ate their young, made love an irredeemable sin. Jack's eyes bugged out. He shook his jowls and waved his hands as if he dipped them in oil. It was a real performance, all of that voice pouring out of so small a vessel, and Delaney found himself laughing, laughing till he felt something uncoil inside him, overcooked turkeys, mucilaginous potatoes, and other culinary disasters notwithstanding. He finished the second beer and wondered if he should have a third. That must have been about 4 in the afternoon. Delaney couldn't place the time exactly in the frantic sequence of events that followed, but he remembered looking at his watch about then and thinking he had to excuse himself soon if there was any hope of serving dinner by 6. And then the sirens went off, and the first of the helicopters sliced overhead, and someone jumped up on one of the tables in the backyard and shouted, "Fire! Fire in the canyon!" Kyra had been enjoying herself. Delaney might have looked constipated, wearing what she liked to think of as his night-before-the-exams face, sweating the little details of their dinner party, the firmness of the turkey, the condition of the silverware, and God knew what else. But she was kicking back, not a care in the world. Everything's under control, she kept telling him. Don't worry. She'd had everything organized for days, right down to the last detail. All it would take was to reheat a few things in the microwave and uncork the wines. She'd already finished her run for the day and swum 40 laps, too, in anticipation of taking on a few superfluous calories. The flowers were cut and arranged, the turkey was in the oven, and Orbelina was more than capable of handling any little emergency that might arise. And while she could have been out showing houses, holidays were always hot, even Thanksgiving, though among holidays it ranked next to last just ahead of Christmas. She figured she deserved a break. When you worked 10 and 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, and sat by the telephone on the 7th and hadn't taken a real vacation in 5 years, not even for your honeymoon, you had to give something back to your family and yourself. Her mother was here. Her sister was on the way. She was giving a dinner party. It was time to relax. Besides, she'd always been curious about Dominic Flood. Erna was forever dropping his name, and there was always something hushed and secretive about the whole business. His conviction, the anklet he had to wear, his wife leaving him. And though he was known to entertain frequently, what else could he do? Kyra had never met him till now or been inside the house either. She had to admit she was favorably impressed. The house was tasteful, nothing splashy or showy, quintessentially southwestern, with a few really fine details like the Talavera tiles in the kitchen set off by a pair of ancient retablos depicting a saint at prayer. And it was interesting to see what he'd done with a floor plan identical to theirs. And the man himself had proven to be no disappointment either. Oozing charm. And with something dangerous in his eyes, the way he glanced at you, the easy crackle of his voice. He'd made one convert, at least. Her mother hadn't left his side since they got there. It was a pity he couldn't come to dinner. Kyra found herself drifting easily from group to group, almost as much at home as if it were her own party. She knew at least half the people here and was curious about the ones she didn't know, Dominic's friends from outside Arroyo Blanco, in the same way she was curious about him. If she'd expected gangster types or little Milkins or whatever, she was disappointed. There wasn't a crack in the facade. She talked to a couple from Brentwood about cacti, 19th-century Japanese prints, property values, and yachts, and to a muddled, bespectacled man in his 30s who seemed to be some sort of scholar devoted to plowing through ancient manuscripts at the Vatican, though to what purpose she never determined. And then there was the group of three, two sisters and the husband of the chunkier of the two, or was it the slimmer, who kept urging her to refill her wine glass, though one was her limit, and with whom she discussed tennis, Nahuatlan figures, property values, and the North American Free Trade Agreement. There wasn't a capo or consigliere in sight. She'd refilled her glass with Evian and was huddled over the canapes with Erna and Zelda Cherrystone, her own little party beginning to splinter off, though her mother was still across the room monopolizing their host, and she was feeling good, really good, for the first time in a long while. Real estate was off her mind for the day at least, though the rest of the weekend would be full bore, the last really big weekend of the season, people trying to get in on a 30-day escrow before Christmas. And the DeRoss place was locked and shuttered and secured for the holiday. She hadn't told anybody yet, Delaney or Jordan, that is. But now that the wall was up and their troubles behind them, she was thinking, just thinking, of another dog. A Sheltie, maybe, for Jordan's birthday. That would bring things full circle. That would start the healing. She looked out the window, and the sun was a golden, beneficent thing, the rich, green, shining leaves of the camellias steeped in it. And she saw in a moment of clarity that it was a thing to reverence and enjoy, the realtor's greatest ally. And she forgot the winds, the late heat, the mad, parched, thirsty air rushing through the canyon for the sea, forgot all about it, until someone got up on a table and shouted, "Fire!" And the day fell to pieces around her. Delaney was no alarmist, but with the first blast of the sirens, he couldn't help but think of Jordan alone, back at the house. He found himself out on the lawn at Dominic Flood's with all the rest of the partygoers, staring into the twisting column of black smoke that rose ominously from the canyon below. There was no need for panic. Not yet. Brush fires broke out routinely up here, and half the time the fire department had them squelched in a matter of hours. And yet the brush was ready to explode, and everyone knew it, no one better than Delaney. He looked round him at the anxious faces of his neighbors, their necks craning, mouths drawn tight, a cold vestigial glint of fear frozen in the depths of their eyes. They'd survived last year's firestorms, and the quake, too, and the mudslides, for that matter. And no one wanted to get hysterical. No one wanted to risk looking foolish. Not yet. Not yet. Still, Delaney found himself edging back through the crowd. "Sorry, excuse me, please, sorry," until he found Kyra and took hold of her arm. "Honey, we better go. I mean, just in case," he said. And already you could smell the smoke, metallic and bitter, and her eyes widened and she breathed a single word. "Jordan." They just got in the car when the wind shifted and the muscular black column of smoke stood up straight in the sky and closed a fist over the sun.
Kit was in the back seat, miffed, dismayed, and thoroughly ruffled, the Menaker groove etched deeply into the flesh between her eyebrows. Delaney had actually had to pry her hand away from the crook of Dominic Flood's arm.
"I can't really see what the fuss is all about," she said petulantly. "We have brush fires all the time in the Bay Area, and they just come in with those planes and snuff them right out."
As if on cue, the first of the bombers roared overhead and dropped its pink cloud of flame retardant into the cauldron below. Delaney said nothing. They'd almost been evacuated last fall, were right on the verge of it, but the main arm of the firestorm had passed 2 or 3 miles behind them, on the far side of the ridge, and the secondary fire had burned its way up the canyon on a collision course with the Royal Blanco until the wind shifted and it fell back into the wasteland it had just created. 18,000 acres had burned, and 350 homes were lost. 3 people died. By the time Delaney reached the driveway, the sun was gone. He backed the car in and left it there, ready for a quick escape if it came to that. The turkey smell hit him as he entered the house, but all the nostalgia it had dredged up earlier was gone now. And he told himself to stay calm. It was probably nothing, as Jordan came wheeling down the hall, hollering, "Mommy, Delaney, there's a fire!" And Orbelina appeared from the kitchen to give them all a quick, anxious look. Kyra bent to hug her son while her own mother looked on bewildered, as if she'd just washed her hands and couldn't find a towel to dry them. No one seemed to know what to do. Was the party on or off? Was the fire just a little thing, a minor inconvenience that would add piquancy to the day and provide a few after-dinner jokes? Or were their lives in danger, their homes, everything they owned? Kyra lifted her eyes to Delaney, and he was aware in that moment that they were all watching him, his wife, her mother, the maid, and Jordan, looking for signals, waiting for him to act, seize the moment, take the bull by the horns. That was when he crossed the room and flicked on the TV, and there it was, the fire, roiling in bright orange beauty, mesmerizing, seductive, the smoke unraveling round the edges as if whole empires were aflame. They all stood there in silence while the camera pulled back to show the bombers diving on the flames and the helicopters hovering with a tiny televised clatter that mocked the booming vibrations overhead, and a voice that couldn't suppress a secret thrill said, "Driven by Santa Ana winds, the blaze, which officials now think began along the bed of Topanga Creek just below Fernwood less than an hour ago, was at first headed toward the Pacific Coast Highway, and all residents of the Lower Canyon are being evacuated. But as you can see from our dramatic helicopter footage, the winds have just now shifted, and the main body of the fire seems to be climbing toward the populated areas around Topanga Village." That was all Kyra needed to hear. "Load up the cars," she cried. And though she was still standing in place, her movements were frantic, as if she were a conductor urging the full orchestra to a crescendo. "I want the photo albums, if nothing else. And Jordan, you pack clothes, hear me? Clothes first, and then you can take video games." "All right," Delaney heard himself say, and his voice was a desperate gulp for air. "And what should I take? The electronics, I guess. The computer, my books." Kit sank heavily into the armchair, her gaze fixed on the TV and the glorious billowing orange-red seduction of the flames. She glanced up at Delaney, at Kyra, at the grim, uncomprehending face of the maid. She was dressed in a champagne suit with a frilly mauve blouse and matching heels, her hair perfectly coiffed, makeup flawless. "Is it really that serious?" No one had moved. Not yet. Not yet. They all turned back to the TV, hoping for a reprieve, hoping that they'd been watching old footage, color-enhanced pictures of the Dresden bombing, anything but the real and actual. But there it was, the fire, in living color, and there the familiar studio set and the anchor person, so familiar they might have been family. The anchor persons were clucking and grieving and admonishing, straining their prototypic features to hear the dramatic eyewitness testimony of a reporter standing on the canyon road with his wind-blown hair and handheld mic. Oh, yes, ladies and gentlemen, this was the real thing. Oh, yes, indeed. Kyra looked as if she were about to lift off and shoot through the ceiling. Orbelina, whose English was limited to a response to the 6 or 7 most common scullery commands, stared at the screen in disbelief, no doubt thinking about her apartment in Pacoima and how she was going to get there if the buses weren't running. And this meant the buses wouldn't be running, didn't it? Jordan clung to his mother's leg. He was staring fascinated at the televised flames, his mother's admonition to pack already forgotten. And Kit, though she sank ever more deeply into the folds of the chair, still didn't seem to understand. "But they haven't told us to evacuate," she protested weakly. "I mean, no one said a word about the upper canyon, did they?"
"We better shut off the turkey," Delaney said, and that seemed to lift the spell. "Just in case."
2.
So she sat there, as miserable as she'd ever been in her life, and closed her mind down till the world went from a movie screen to a peephole. And still she wanted to close the peephole, too. She was going mad, dancing round the edges of the abyss, and she didn't care. The baby grew, and it pressed on her organs and made her skin flush with a stipple of red like a rash. Candido gave her food, and she ate it. But she wouldn't sleep with him, wouldn't talk to him. It was all his fault, everything, from the stale air in the bus on the ride from Cuernavaca to Tijuana and the smell of the dump to this place, this vacancy of leaves and insects and hot, naked air where men did dirty things to her and made her pee burn like fire. She looked through her peephole at the gray leaves of the gray trees and thought of Soledad Ordóñez, the stooped old shapeless woman from the San Miguel barrio who didn't speak to her husband for 22 years because he sold their pig in San Andres and was drunk for a week on the proceeds. He was dying, stretched out on his deathbed with the priest and their 3 sons and 4 daughters there and all their 17 grandchildren and his brother too, and he could barely croak out the words, "Soledad, talk to me." And her face was stone, and the priest and the brother and all the grandchildren held their breath, and she said one word, "Drunkard," and he died. America missed her mother with a pain of longing so intense it was as if some part of her body had been removed. She missed her sisters and her bed in the corner of the back room with the posters of rock stars and Las Reinas del Cine above it and Gloria Iglesias and Remedios Esparza and the other girls she used to go around with. She missed human voices, laughter, the smells of the street and marketplace, the radio, TV, dances, and shops and restaurants. And who had deprived her of all this? Candido. And she hated him for it. She couldn't help herself. But then one day, lying there by the desolate stream like some dead thing, America heard a bird calling. 3 high-pitched notes, and then a quavering, sustained, low-throated whistle that broke her heart with the sadness of it, over and over, that sad, beautiful bird calling for her mate, her love, her husband. And America felt the sun touch her face like the hand of God, and the peephole snapped open like the shutter of a camera. It wasn't much, just a fraction, the tiniest opening, but from that day on, she began to recover. Her baby was coming. Candido loved her. She made coffee the next morning, cooked him a meal. When he was gone, she dug out the peanut butter jar and counted the limp gray bills there, the silver hoard of change, and she thought, soon, soon. She wouldn't talk to him yet. She wouldn't smile at him. She hurt with a disappointment so yawning and wide she couldn't help spilling him into it, holding his head down in the black, bitter waters. And that was true and unchanging and ongoing. But each day now, the gulf inside her began to close even as the peephole widened. And now, today, when he came back with the turkey that had dropped down out of heaven, the Thanksgiving turkey, she couldn't make him suffer anymore. She was no Señora Ordóñez. She couldn't live a life of accusation and hatred, serving the coffee in a funereal dress, throwing down the plate of eggs and beans as if it were a weapon, always biting her lip and cursing in her head. She laughed to see him there. Wet to the waist, the clink of the beer bottles, the big naked bird, and gobble, gobble, gobble. He clowned for her, danced round the sandspit with the bird atop his head, doing a silly jogging brinco step like a man strapped to a jackhammer. The leaves were green again, the sky blue. She got up and held him. And the fire, when it leapt to the trees like the coming of the apocalypse, didn't affect her, not at first, not for a minute anyway. She was so intent on driving the sharp green stake of oak through the frozen carcass of the bird, so fixated on the image of crackling brown skin and rice with drippings, so happy to be alive again, that the roar didn't register. Not until she looked up and saw Candido's face and every living leaf and branch and bole wrapped in a vesture of flame. That was half a second before the panic set in, half a second before the numbing, crazy, bone-bruising flight up the hill, but half a second in which she wished with all her heart that she'd been strong enough to let the peephole close down forever.
For Candido, it was a moment of pure gut-clenching terror, the moment of the fatal mistake and the reaping of the consequences. What would he liken it to? Nothing. Nothing he'd ever seen except maybe the time in Arizona when the man they called Sleepy burned to death under the tractor when his cigarette ignited a spill of gasoline from the tank. Candido had been up his ladder in a lemon tree, picking, and he heard the muted cry, saw the flames leap up and then the bright, exploding ball of them. But now he was on the ground, and the flames were in the trees, swooping through the canyon with a mechanical roar that stopped his heart. There was no heat like this. No furnace, no bomb, no reactor. Every visible thing danced in the flames. America was going to die. He was going to die. Not in a rocking chair on the porch of his little house, surrounded by his grandchildren, but here and now, in the pit of this unforgiving canyon. Ahead of them, down the only trail he knew, the flames rose up in a 40-foot curtain. Behind them was the sheer rock wall of their cul-de-sac. He was no mountain goat, and America was so big around she could barely waddle, but what did it matter? He sprang at her, jerked her up from the sand and the white frozen carcass of the bird, and it would cook now all right, and pulled her across the spit to the rock wall and the trickle of mist that fell intermittently from above. "Climb!" he screamed, shoving her up ahead of him, pushing at her bottom and the big swollen ball of her belly, fighting for finger and toe holds, and they were climbing, both of them, scaling the sheer face of the rock as if it were a jungle gym. The heat seared his skin through the fabric of his shirt, stung the exposed flesh of his hands and face. There was no air, not a breath, all the oxygen sucked up to feed the inferno, and with each step the rock went rotten beneath their feet. He didn't think they were going to make it. But then he gave America a final frantic shove, and they were over the top and sitting in a puddle of water in a place that was as new to him as the backside of the moon, though he'd lived within spitting distance of it all these months. There were no pools here, no rills or falls. There was hardly any water at all. A staggered run of puddles retreated to the next tumble of rock, and beyond that it was more of the same, the canyon a trap, its walls 100 feet high, unbroken, impregnable. The wind screamed. It screamed for blood, for sacrifice, for Thanksgiving. And the flames answered it, leaping behind them to the height of the ledge with a roar like 1,000 jets taking off at once. And then Candido and America were running up the stream bed, stumbling over rocks, splashing through the muck and tearing the flesh of their arms and hands and feet on the talons of the scrub till they reached the next obstruction and went up over it, and still they kept going. "Don't stop! No!" Candido cried, slapping furiously at America every time she faltered. "Keep going! Run, mujer! Run!" The wind could change direction at any moment, at whim, and if it did, they were dead, and he knew they should have been dead already, cremated along with the turkey. He urged her on, shoved and shouted and half-carried her. The canyon was a funnel, a conduit, the throat of an inconceivable flamethrower, and they had to get up and out of it, up to the road and across the blacktop and on up through the chaparral to the high, barren rock of the highest peak. That was all he could think of, up. Up and up, that naked rock, high above it all, and there was nothing to burn up there, was there? They fumbled round a turning in the stream bed, the wall falling back and away from them as the gorge widened. And there it was, the answer to Candido's half-formed prayers. A way out. A second mountain lay at their feet, a mountain of junk hurled over the precipice above by generations of heedless gabachos. "Climb!" Candido shouted, and America, sweating, bleeding, tears of rage and fear and frustration in her eyes, began to climb up over the hood of an accordioned car, her belly swinging out and away from her like an untethered balloon. Candido scrambled up behind her, knocking aside toasters, water heaters, bed springs, the refuse of 1,000 kitchens and garages. The mass gave gently but held, locked in place by the heavy settled chassis of the automobiles, and as the smell of smoke came to them, as the wind shifted and the flames sent up a demonic howl, they reached the beaten hardpan promontory and struggled through the brush to the road. The road was chaos. Firefighters ran shouting up and down the length of it. Sirens wailed, lights flashed, the police were there, everywhere. The road closed going down, the last straggling automobiles coming up. Candido took his wife by the hand and hurried up the road to the Chinese store, closed and shuttered and without a car in the lot, and ducked around back, searching along the foundation for a hose bib. They collapsed there, behind the store, gulping water from a hose, precious water, wetting their faces, soaking their clothes.
A little water the Chinamen wouldn't mind, and who gave a damn if they did?
Candido's throat was raw. A big airplane, hunkering low, brushed the treetops overhead.
"I'm scared," America whispered.
"Don't be scared," he said, though he himself was terrified. What would they do to him now? What would they do if they found out? They had the gas chamber here in California, didn't they?
Sure they did.
They'd put him in a little room with cyanide pellets, and his lungs would fill with the corrosive fumes. But he wouldn't breathe. Wouldn't open his mouth. He wouldn't.
He took a long drink from the slack hose and thought he was going to vomit.
The smoke was blacker now, pouring over them. The wind had changed and the fire was coming up the canyon.
"Get up," he said, and his voice was shot through with urgency, with panic, infested with it, a crazy man's voice. "We gotta go, now!"
She sat there in the mud from the hose, her big maternity shorts soaked through, the big wet folds of the maternity blouse clinging to the perfect ball of her belly, hair in her mouth, her face smudged and bleeding, her eyes wild.
"No," she said. "I won't get up. I'm tired. I feel sick."
He jerked her to her feet.
"You want to burn?" he shouted, and his grip on her arm was punishing. "You want to die?"
The smoke thickened. There was no one around, no one, and it was eerie, spooky, like some horror movie with the aliens closing in. Sirens wailed in the distance. America snatched her arm away from him, curled her lip to show her teeth.
"Yes," she hissed.
"Yes, I do." It was dark, darker than Candido could ever have imagined it. All the homes in the canyon without electricity, the people evacuated, a pall of smoke closing over the sky against the distant flare of the fire. From here, high up the canyon, the fire sat low on the horizon, like a gas burner glowing under the great black pot of the sky. The winds had died down with nightfall, and the blaze was in remission, settling into its bed of coals to await the coming of the day and the return of the winds. Or maybe they would put it out. Maybe the gringos would keep attacking it with their planes and their chemicals till they'd snubbed it out like a cigarette ground under the heel of a boot. Candido didn't know what the next day would bring, but as he looked down into the darkened canyon, he felt awed by the enormity of his bad luck, stunned by the chain of events that had led him from the windfall of the turkey and the simple joy of the campfire to this nightmare of flames and smoke and airplanes that exploded across the sky. Had he really been the cause of all this? One man with a match? It was almost inconceivable. Too much for his poor, fevered brain to take in. But he didn't want to think about it. He was in trouble, deep trouble, and he needed to take stock of the situation. He was lost, hungry, with $16.37 and a rusted switchblade in his pocket, and all their hoard of money, their apartment fund, buried somewhere in the midst of the conflagration, and for the past 2 hours America had been complaining of pains deep in her gut, pains down there where the baby was. And wouldn't it be just his luck if the baby came now at the worst possible time? It was the story of his life, pinched like a bug between two granite rocks, and how long before he was squashed. They were lying in a clump of bushes somewhere halfway up the western rim of the canyon, and he knew what a worthless plan it had been to try for the top. The fire would have caught them in the chaparral, and they wouldn't have had a chance. But he was afraid of the road, of all those gringo police and firemen, and he was guilty and scared and ashamed, and all he could think of was making it to that peak where they'd be safe. He'd been stupid, panicky and stupid. But now the fire was back in its lair, at least till morning. And they were in the middle of nowhere, and America lay beside him like a shadow, crying out with pain every few seconds. What now? What next? They didn't even have water.
"I'm afraid," America said for the second time that day, her voice pinched and low, coming at him out of the void.
All around them the brush crepitated with the tiny feet of rodents and lizards and the shuffling slink of snakes and insects fleeing the fire. There was a crash of bigger things, too, deer, he supposed, and a persistent stirring and scratching of dead leaves that could have been anything from a skunk to a bobcat. He didn't answer her, not right away, not until he confirmed what he'd been dreading.
"Candido," she whispered, "I think my water broke. The baby's coming, I can't help it."
She paused to draw in a sharp breath.
"It's coming." "It's going to be all right," he told her. and he knelt beside her in the dark and ran his fingers over her face and stroked her brow, but all the while he could feel the little wheels racing inside him. There was no doctor here, no midwife, no apartment, no hospital, electricity, water, no roof even. He'd never delivered a baby. He'd never seen one delivered, except in the movies, and then it always happened off-camera, the honey-skinned actress in a sweat and crying out, a jerk of the camera, and there it was, the baby, clean and healthy and beautiful and wrapped in a snowy towel. America moaned, a deep, quavering gasp of a moan that made his legs go weak with fear. She was so small, too small. This wasn't the way it was supposed to be.
Candido, she whispered. I'm thirsty. So thirsty.
He got to his feet. The night clung to him like a stocking. Off in the distance, to the north, there was a string of lights, cars turning back at the top of the canyon, a police cordon maybe, and just to the west of that was the staging area for the helicopters. But that was at least 3 or 4 miles as the crow flies, and how could he get her there? And if he did, then what? They'd seize him in a minute. A Mexican coming out of the bushes and the whole canyon ablaze. They'd see it in his eyes, see it in the color of his skin and the way he slouched up to them like a whipped dog. And what kind of mercy could he expect then? You stay here, he told her, his own voice as strange in his ears as a disembodied voice talking out of the radio. I'm going to see if I can't find a house or... He didn't finish the thought. Don't worry, mi vida. I'll be just a minute. I'll find help. I will. And then he was weaving his way through the scrub, drawn like an insect to the promise of the distant lights. A helicopter clattered off down the valley, its running lights blinking green and red. Something plunged into the bushes ahead of him. He went 100 feet and called out. America answered him. He couldn't go too far or he'd lose her. He knew that. And he was afraid of losing her, lightheaded with the thought of it. But what else could he do? He decided he would only go 200 feet, counting out the steps aloud, then double back and go out in the opposite direction. The hills were studded with houses, houses climbing the hills like some sort of blight. There were hundreds of houses out here, hundreds, and roads, electric poles, water mains, sewers. There were trash cans and automobiles and pavement. There had to be something here. There had to be. He shouted out twice more and heard America's weak bleat of response, all the while counting higher, 181, 182, as he eased through the brush like a man tiptoeing across a minefield. He was worried about his feet, all the snakes on the move, the son and brother and uncle of that one he'd killed. But he went on, feeling his way, and what choice did he have? He'd rather be attacked by all the snakes in the world than have to deliver that baby out here in the desert of the night, or anywhere for that matter. He was no doctor. He was a fool stumbling through an ever-expanding obstacle course, the cards stacked against him, the fates howling, and everything that was good or precious or even possible depended on him and him alone. He'd reached 195, the wheels racing, despair in his gut. When he saw a faint glow ahead, and then, all of a sudden, it was there, and he was pressed against it. A wall. A white stucco wall. Candido worked his way along the wall, feeling for an opening. There was no light, but for the unsteady glow of the fire in the distance, and the sky was black as the night sky in Tepoztlan during the rains. Gone was the yellow reflection of the city, every last watt of light driven down and conquered by the smoke of his little campfire that had gone berserk. The thought frightened him all over again. All this, the magnitude of it, if they caught him, oh, his pinche life would be worth nothing then. But what was he thinking? What did his life matter? America was the one. She'd followed him into this mess, and she was out there now, the underbrush rustling with rats and crawling things, out there in the utter absence of light, and her baby was coming, and she was thirsty and tired and scared. The wind had shifted yet again, and that meant the flames were climbing back toward them, relentless, implacable, eating up the canyon despite all that the gringos and their airplanes could do. It was hard to breathe, and he could smell nothing but smoke and cinders and the burning stench of destruction, worse, far worse than anything the Tijuana dump could offer. Even the smell of the dead, burning flesh of the dogs was preferable to this, because this was his smell, his creation, and it was out of control. He kept going, faster now, patting furiously at the wall, the copper taste of panic rising in his throat. And what was behind the wall? Houses, he guessed.
the houses of the rich. Or maybe a ranch, one of those big squared-off places with a single house set squarely in the middle of it. He wasn't sure exactly where he was. The flight up the canyon and across the road had disoriented him. But they wouldn't have built a wall around nothing. He had to get inside, had to find out. And then the shed was there, announced by a sharp pain in his knee and the dull, booming reverberation of aluminum. He felt his way around it to the back and the door that opened on the black hole of the interior. It was hot inside, baked by the sun all day till it was like one of the sweat lodges the reservation Indians used in their rituals, and the aluminum ceiling was low. There was a sharp smell of chlorine and of grass clippings, gasoline, and manure. Even before he let his hands interpret the place for him, Candido knew what it was. He felt around the walls like a blind man. He was a blind man, but a blind man in a hurry, a rush, life and death. And the tools were all there, the shovels and the shears and the weed whippers. His hands darted over the lawnmower, one of those ones you sit in like a little tractor, the plastic buckets of chlorine and muriatic acid and all the rest of it. And then he found the shelves and felt over the boxes of seed and gopher pellets until, milagro de milagros, his fingers closed round the throat of a kerosene lantern. Half a minute and it was lit, and the shed was a place of depth and color. He stepped outside with the lantern, and there, tucked in against the wall right at his feet, was a faucet and a green hose coiled up against the plastic pipe of the irrigation system. He found a cup in the shed and drank off 3 cups of water before filling it for America, and then he went off to get her, the lantern puddling light at his feet and throwing a dim halo into the bushes before him. He followed the wall back to where he jammed a stick in the ground to guide him and went off at a right angle from that, calling out to her as he went. The dirt was pale, the bushes paler. Smoke rolled over the hill like a deadly fog. "Here," she called. "Over here." It was hot. It smelled bad. She was scared. She couldn't believe she was having her baby in a place like this, with the whole world on fire and nobody to help her, no midwife, no doctor, not even a curandera. And the pain. Everything was so tight down there, squeezing in, always in, when it should be pushing out. She was in a shed, floating in a sea of rustling plastic sacks of grass seed, the sweat shining all over her like cooking oil, and Candido fussing around with his knife, sharpening it now on a whetstone, as if he could be of any use at all. The pains came regularly now, every minute or so, and they took away her breath. She wanted to cry out for her mother, for Tepoztlan, for everything she'd left behind. But she held it all in, everything in, always in, and why not out? And then again, and again. She was dreaming, awake and dreaming, but the dreams were full of teeth and claws and the howls of animals. Outside, beyond the thin skin of the shed, the inferno rushed toward them and the winds rattled the walls with a pulse like a drumbeat, and Candido's face was a glowing ball of sweat and worry. She knew what he was thinking. Should they run? And how could they run with the baby coming now? And why did it have to come now of all times? And who had elected him the sole target of all the world's calamities? But she couldn't help him. She could barely move, and the pains were gripping her and then releasing again till she felt like a hard rubber ball slammed against a wall over and over. And then, in the middle of it all, with the terrible clenching pains coming one after the other, the animals suddenly stopped howling and the wind ceased its incessant drumming at the walls. America heard the fire then, a crackling hiss like the TV turned up full volume in the middle of the night and nothing on, and then a thin, mewling whine that was no howl or screech, but the tentative interrogatory meow of a cat. A pretty little Siamese with transparent ears that stepped through the open door and came right up to her as if it knew her. She held out her hand and then clenched her fist with the pain of a contraction, and the cat stayed with her. "Gatita," she whispered to the arching back and the blue, luminous eyes. "You're the one. You're the saint. You. You will be my midwife."
3. The night came down like a hammer. No gently fading light, no play of colors on the horizon, no flight of swallows or choruses of crickets. Delaney watched it from behind the police barrier at the top of Topanga Canyon, his wife, stepson, and mother-in-law at his side. Their friends and neighbors were gathered there with them, refugees in Land Rovers, Mercedes-Benzes, and Jeep Cherokees that were packed to the windows with their cardinal possessions. The college yearbooks, the Miles Davis albums, the financial records, the TVs and VCRs, the paintings and rugs and jewelry. Bombers pounded overhead while fire trucks, sirens whining, shot down the road. Emergency lights flashed, strobing endlessly across the panorama of masked and anxious faces, and police stood tall against the strips of yellow plastic that held back the crowd. It was war, and no mistaking it. Kyra leaned into Delaney, gripping his arm with both hands, her head on his shoulder. She was still dressed for the party. They gazed out on the distant flames and smelled the smoke and felt the wind in their faces while dogs yapped and hastily trailered horses whinnied and the radios from 100 cars blared out the catastrophic news. "I guess this means we can forget the turkey," Delaney said. "It'll be like jerky by now."
"Turkey?" Kyra lifted her face to fix him with an acid look. "What about the oven, the kitchen, the roof? What about all our furniture, our clothes? Where are we going to live?"
Delaney felt a stab of irritation.
"I was just being, I don't know, ironic."
She turned away from him, her eyes on the creeping, molten fingers of the fire.
"It's no joke, Delaney. 2 of my listings went up in the Malibu fire last year, and believe me, there was nothing left, nothing but smoldering ash and metal twisted up out of the ground where the plumbing used to be. And if you think that's funny, you must have a pretty sick sense of humor. That's our house down there. That's everything we own." "What in Christ's name are you talking about? You think I think this is funny? It's not. It's terrifying. It scares the shit out of me. We never had anything like this in New York. Maybe a hurricane or something every 10 years or so, a couple of trees knocked down. But this..."
She detached herself from him then and shouted out to Jordan, who'd been darting in and out of the knots of people with one of his friends, to stay close. Then she turned back to Delaney.
"Maybe you should have stayed there then," she said, her voice harsh with anger, and she went off in the direction of her mother and Dom Flood.
Delaney watched her go. She was throwing it all on his shoulders, making him the scapegoat, and he felt put upon and misunderstood, felt angry, pissed off, rubbed raw. He'd done his best. He'd managed to get his word processor and discs into the car in the 10 minutes the police had given them between the first and final warnings, a pair of cruisers crawling up and down the street with their loudspeakers blaring. But that was all. 10 minutes. What could you do in 10 minutes? He was frozen with grief and anxiety. How could she doubt that? He hadn't meant anything about the turkey. It was gallows humor, that was all, an attempt to break the tension. What did a turkey matter? 1,000 turkeys.
He was standing there in the garish light, the wind in his face and his entire cranial cavity filled with smoke, angry at the world. What next, he was thinking? What more could they do to him? When Jack Cherrystone appeared at his side with a bottle of liquor in his hand.
"It's hell, isn't it?"
Jack rumbled, and he might have been doing a trailer for the next disaster movie.
"Yeah," Delaney said, his eyes focused on the advancing line of the fire and the furious, roiling skeins of smoke.
"And what worries me is they evacuated us, which they didn't do last year, and that must mean they think this is worse, or potentially worse."
Jack didn't have anything to say to this, but Delaney felt the touch of his hand, the hard, hot neck of the bottle.
"Glenfiddich," Jack said. "Couldn't let that burn."
Delaney didn't drink hard liquor, and the 2 beers he'd had at Dominic's would have constituted his limit under normal circumstances. But he took the bottle, held it to his lips, and let the manufactured fire burn its way down to the deepest part of him. It was then that he spotted the 2 men walking up the road out of the darkness, their faces obscured by the bills of their baseball caps. Something clicked in his head, even at this distance, something familiar in the spidery long stride of the one in front. And then he knew. This was the jerk with the flies, the wise-ass, the camper. Amazing, he thought, and he didn't try to correct himself. Not now, not ever again. Amazing how the scum comes to the surface.
"Fucking wetbacks," Jack growled. "I lay you odds they started this thing, smoking pot down there, cooking their fucking beans out in the woods."
And now Delaney recognized the 2nd man, too, the one with the coiled hair and the serape. He was dirty,
covered in white dust from his sandaled feet to the dangling ends of his hair, and there were seed pods and burrs and slices of needle grass clinging to his clothes. They were both dirty, Delaney saw now, as if they'd been rolling through the brush, and he imagined them trying to get up and around the roadblock and the chaparral and then finally having to give it up. He watched the two of them working their slow way up the road toward the flashing lights. No hurry, no worry, everything's cool. And he felt as much pure hatred as he'd ever felt in his life. What the hell did they think they were doing here anyway, starting fires in a tinderbox? Didn't they know what was at stake here? Didn't they know they weren't in Mexico anymore? Come on, we can't let these jokers get through, Jack said. And he had his hand on Delaney's arm, and they were moving off in the direction of the roadblock to intercept them. I mean, we got to alert the cops, at least. But the cops were alert already. When Delaney got there with Jack, one of the patrolmen, he looked Hispanic, dark-skinned, with a mustache, was questioning the two men in Spanish, his flashlight stabbing first at one face, then the other. Normally, Delaney would have stood off at a respectful distance, but he was anxious and irate and ready to lay the blame where it belonged, and he could feel the liquor burning in his veins. Officer, he said, coming right up to them, joining the group, I want to report that I've seen this man, pointing now at the glowering, twisted face, in the lower canyon, camping. Camping right down there where the fire started. He was excited now, beyond caring. Somebody had to pay for this. And so what if he hadn't actually seen the man lying there drunk in his filthy sleeping bag? It was close enough, wasn't it? The policeman turned to him, lights flashing, the scream of a siren, bombs away. And he had the same face as the shorter man, the one in the blanket, black, Aztecan eyes, iron cheekbones, the heavy mustache, and white, gleaming teeth. I can handle this, he said. And his voice went cold, and he said something vicious and accusatory in rapid-fire Spanish to the two men. It didn't seem to have much effect. The tall one reached up lazily to twist his hat around so that the bill faced backwards and gave first the cop and then Delaney an impassive look. He said something extenuating, or at least that was what it sounded like. That was when Jack spoke up, his voice a magnificent trumpeting instrument that jerked the whole group to attention, the Mexicans, the cop, even Delaney. Officer, he boomed. I've seen these men too, I'm sure of it, and I'd like to know what they were doing down there at the scene of a very suspicious fire. Those are our homes down there, that's everything we have, and if arson was involved, I damn well want to know about it. A crowd had begun to gather. Delaney and Jack hadn't been the only ones to spot the Mexicans coming up the road. "That's right!" a shrill voice called out at Delaney's back, a female voice, and he turned round on a heavy-set woman with muddy eyes and a silver hoop in her right nostril. She wore a shawl over a heavy brocade dress that trailed in the dirt and hid her shape. "And I want to know, too!" she cried, stumbling over the last two syllables, and Delaney saw that she was drunk. By this point, a second patrolman had joined the first, a ramrod CHP officer with a pale blonde crew cut bristling against the brim of his hat. He gave a quick glance round him to size up the situation, stared down the big woman with the nose ring, and then, ignoring the other cop, said something in Spanish to the two Mexicans, and now they jumped all right. The next second they were both lying prone in the dirt, legs spread, arms scissored at the back of their heads, and the new cop was patting them down. Delaney felt a thrill of triumph and hate. He couldn't suppress it. And then both cops were bending over the suspects to clamp the handcuffs round their wrists, and the tall Mexican, Delaney's special friend, was protesting his innocence in two languages. The son of a bitch. The jerk. The arsonist. It was all Delaney could do to keep from wading in and kicking him in the ribs. Somebody's dog was barking, raging in primal fury, and the sirens tore at the air. There must have been 30 or 40 people gathered now, and more coming. They took a step back when the cops hauled the suspects to their feet, but Delaney was right there, right in the thick of it, Jack at his side. He saw the dirt and bits of weed on the front of the Mexican shirts, saw the individual bristles of their unshaven throats and jowls. The tall one's hat had been knocked askew so that the brim jutted out at a crazy angle. The handcuffs sparked in the repetitive light. No one moved. And then the big woman shouted a racial slur, and the Hispanic cop's head jerked round. That was when Delaney felt the tall Mexican's eyes on him.
It was like that day out on the Cherry Stones lawn, the same look of contempt and corrosive hate. But this time, Delaney didn't flinch, didn't feel guilt or pity or even the slightest tug of common humanity. He threw the look back at the son of a bitch and put everything he had into it, clenching his teeth so hard his jaw ached. Then, just as the blonde cop pulled at the man's arm to swing him round and march him off toward the squad car, the Mexican spat, and Delaney felt the wet on his face, saw it there spotting the lenses of his glasses, and he lost all control. The next thing he knew, he was on the guy, flailing with his fists, even as the crowd surged forward and the Mexican kicked out at him and the cop wedged his way between them.
"Motherfucker!"
the Mexican screamed over his shoulder as the cop wrestled him away.
"I kill you! I kill you, motherfucker! Fuck you!"
Delaney roared, and Jack Cherrystone had to hold him back.
"Arsonist!"
somebody shouted.
"Spick!"
And the crowd erupted in a cacophony of threats and name-calling.
"Go back to Mexico!"
shouted a man in a sports shirt like Delaney's, while the woman beside him cried, "Wetbacks!" over and over till her face was swollen with it. The cops thrust their prisoners behind them, and the blonde one stepped forward, his hand on his holster.
"You people back off, or I'll run you in, all of you," he shouted, the cord standing out in his throat. "We got a situation here, don't you understand that? And you're just making it worse. Now back off! I mean it!"
No one moved. The smoke lay on the air like poison, like doom. Delaney looked round at his neighbors, their faces drained and white, fists clenched, ready to go anywhere, do anything, seething with it, spoiling for it, a mob. They were out here in the night, outside the walls, forced out of their shells, and there was nothing to restrain them. He stood there a long moment, the gears turning inside him, and when Jack offered the bottle again, he took it. Ultimately, it was the winds that decided the issue. The fire burned to within 500 yards of Arroyo Blanco, swerving west and on up the wash and back of the development and over the ridge where it was finally contained. Night choked down the Santa Ana winds, and in the morning an onshore flow pumped moisture into the air, and by 10 a.m., after sleeping in their cars, in motels, on the couches of friends, relatives, employees, and casual acquaintances, the people of Arroyo Blanco were allowed to return to their homes. Delaney was hungover and contrite. He'd all but started a riot, and the thought frightened him. He remembered the time he'd participated in an anti-nuke demonstration with his first wife, Louise, and how it seemed as if the whole world was against them, or worse, when they went up the steps of the abortion clinic in White Plains and the hard-line crazies had yabbered at them like dogs, faces twisted with rage and hate till they were barely human. Delaney had thrown it right back at them, defiant and outraged. The issue was personal, deeply personal, and he and Louise had agonized over their decision. They weren't ready yet, that was all, and why bring a child into a world already teeming with its starving billions? But the protesters wouldn't let them be, didn't even see them as individuals. Well, he was one of them now. He was the hater. He was the redneck, the racist, the abuser. There was no evidence that those men had a thing to do with the fire. They could have been fleeing on foot, thumbing a ride, walking up the road to take in the sights, hiking. As sober as he was, as ashamed and repentant, he couldn't suppress a flare of outrage at the thought, hiking the son of a bitch. But then, he asked himself, would he have felt the same way if the men walking up the road had been white? They had to show their address on their licenses to get back through the police cordon. The road was open to residents only, as a means of discouraging looters. And Delaney, with Jordan beside him, followed Kyra and her mother down the road through the as-yet-unmanned gate and into the development. Delaney rolled down his window, and the lingering odor of charred brush and timber filled the car with a smell that reminded him of the incinerator at his grandmother's apartment all those years ago. Or the dump. The Croton dump, smoldering under an umbrella of seagulls. But the development was untouched, pristine in the morning light. His neighbors were pulling into their driveways, unloading their cars, striding across deep-watered lawns to check the gates, the pool, the tool shed, all of them wearing the faint, vacant half-smiles of the reprieved. Disaster had been averted. It was the morning after. As they swung into Piñon, Jordan began to lean forward in his seat, dangling like a gymnast from his shoulder strap. He was dirty, dressed in the grass-stained shorts, T-shirt, and Dodgers cap he'd been wearing when the alarm sounded, and he was wide-eyed from lack of sleep. It had been past midnight when they'd finally decided to get a room at the Holiday Inn in Woodland Hills, the last room available. All he'd been able to talk about was Dame Edith, the cat, who'd managed to vanish just as they were loading the car.